table tonight to deliberate on the solutions to fix Ghana's energy sector. So we have assembled some of the best brains in the energy sector to help us, together with you at home, help government to deal with this challenge. And we know that we believe this will be once and for all. My name is Samuel Kojo-Briz, and it's always my pleasure to welcome you to the Joyous National Dialogue. And today we're looking at guaranteeing reliable power supply. For the next 3 hours, let's find the solutions together. Welcome. Now let's share with you where we have come from to where we are today, starting from what we've been able to piece together. So if you look at what we have, in case of electricity access rate, we have 88.75%. So a total population of over 30 million. How many of us have electricity? At 88.75%. What, in terms of numbers, what does this stand for? It is around over 20 million. So, I mean, to put it succinctly, we have around 21 point something million people. So 27.8 million people, Ghanaians, who have access to electricity. That's what we're talking about. So this is important because when there are power outages, it means that about 27.8 Ghanaians are the ones suffering from the power outages, what we call doomsho. Okay, so let's tell you more about, you know, this major electricity crisis. Now, what even brings this home for us to really understand where we are is that in terms of power outages, from January to March 2024, we recorded 4,142. So this really puts this beyond argument or discussion about whether we are in doomsday or not, because from January to March, we recorded 4,142 outages. This means that in a day, we record 44 power outages. And this is nationwide. You must understand that, I mean, in terms of Ghana, it's not only ECG that controls it. We have ECG and we have NEDCO. So, or NEDCO and ECG customers combined, we've recorded 44 outages a day since January to March. We're in April, so the number has gone up. Now, let's understand that this is not the first time we're going through this. I told you earlier, I mean, in the lead up to the 2016 election, this was a major issue. You need to understand that, I mean, every government in the Fourth Republic has had to deal with doomsday in the Rawlings' time. You remember those days when we used to watch Acapulco? I mean, when there's no power in your house, you would walk to a house where there is power for you to watch. Those were the days we're experiencing those doomsday. Now, Kufuor's time was also not exempted from this. He also had to deal with some sort of doomsday himself, I mean, in that regime, before we moved into the Mills Mahama regime. And that was when we went through the most critical period of experiencing the harshest kind of doomsday, because from 2012 to 2015, we had to deal with doomsday. And in terms of money that a country lost, we lost $686.4 million within that period, from 2012 to 2015. This was the money we lost annually. So if you calculate by the number of years, it tells you the extent of money that we lost to doomsday within that period. So it tells you that, in fact, there's a lot more for us to deal with. Now, what is the cost of doomsday between 2012 and 2015 then? We understand that 885 SMEs lost 250 million cedis cumulatively. That's huge. How many SMEs got folded up? Now, around 85 SMEs had to fold up. And that talks about job creation then, you know, because if around 85 SMEs or 55 or so had to shut down, then it tells you that if each one of them was employing, say, 100 people, how many people lost their jobs there? So it brings it home. So that's the cost of doing so in that period from 2012 to 2015. You know, losing over $600 million a year for that 3 years. And then we understand that 885 SMEs lost 250 million, you know, cumulatively. And then 55 SMEs got closed down. That is how, you know, this whole thing. But let's also try and share with you more about, you know, this whole doomsday crisis and where we've been to. Now, let me share with you, you know, the cost of the power outages from what we have learned and from what the experts say. What we do know is that financial challenges are one of the issues why we are where we are. Now, again, we understand that for supply challenges, if you don't have money, how can you buy the fuel to power the thermal plant? Now, you understand that in the energy mix of this country, thermal plant constitute majority, and therefore you need fuel to power them. So if you don't have money, you can't buy fuel, and therefore the challenges will continue. We also know that there are other infrastructural challenges, because we know we have plants that are down for maintenance, plants that need to be worked on, that are not, plants that are out because of some fault. All these form part of the challenges. We also do know that there are power generation challenges, because if the plants are down, if you don't have fuel to power them, of course, you cannot generate power. And that's why we are where we are. Now, so I've already spoken to you about our generation mix. Now, thermal, which is fuel dependent, makes up 64.4%. That takes a chunk of our generation mix. For hydro, it's 34.9%. But you do know that Gridco told us recently that even Bui is almost getting to its limit. Therefore, we only use it at peak times. So depending on the water levels, you cannot even have absolute power coming from Bui when you want to use it throughout the day because of the level of the water. Now, solar, we have around 0.7%. And then, waste, we're not there yet. Well, let's look at the adverse effect of doom salt now. Now, we know that because there's no fuel for us to power the plant, and then of course your power supply will decrease because you don't have power. The generation is not enough to meet how much you need. Then of course, when there's not enough to supply, what do? We have to shed the power, we have to share amongst ourselves. And then of course, it then leads to what we've all come to accept as doom salt. So that is what it then. This is coming from the Mines and Energy Committee of Parliament. Now, let's look at the projected cost of fuel, what we need in this year to fuel the plant that we do have. The Energy Commission says, if it looks at what we are to consume for 2024, we have to spend $1.14 billion to buy fuel. Remember, we've gone to the IMF for a $3 billion loan. Just yesterday, the Kumasi one also came on board. So it means that even the amount of fuel we will need for this year will be more than $1.14 billion. So you're using almost more than a quarter of what you went to borrow to buy fuel if you don't get it from ECG, the funds from ECG. So that's how it is. Now let's look at how much fuel we consume in a day, to produce power. Now what we demand is 450 million standard cubic feet of gas. What we're able to get is 390 million cubic feet of gas. So what we have in deficit is 60 million standard cubic feet of gas. That's what you need so that you'd avoid doing so. Let's share with you, what we are not able to utilize from the energy capacity. 42% of total installed capacity is not utilized. Why? Because we are made to understand that some of the plants, we don't have power, we don't have money to buy fuel for them. Some are, our inability to. Okay, so some of them too are down for maintenance and other issues. So some of them we're not able to get. But whilst we're going through this doom so, how is it impacting you and I? Now the Ghana Medical Association say that in terms of hospitals, they are unable to access patient files. And whilst you are not able to do that, you know what that means. Again, expensive medical equipment that we even find difficult to buy because of the power outages are being destroyed. That's according to the GMA. So you're not able to buy, but when we buy too because of doom salt, then they keep breaking. Now again, we were warned that it could lead to possible decomposition of bodies. When that happens, health implications would have to come in here. So this is what, the whole thing, talks about in terms of what the impact of doom salt will be. Well, we've been running our own doom salt diaries to tell the stories of how the power crisis is affecting Ghanaians trying so hard to put food on the table of their families. My colleague James Aveji spoke to some people who run cold store business in Accra and came through this report.
So, I'm here in the heart of Malata Market in Accra to explore the doom salt diary of operators of frozen food shops, your popular cold stores. The buzzing business of buying and selling is the demand for frozen foods, fish, meat, and others. At least today, the lights are on in the market, but operators of these cold stores, just like you and I, have been battling a peculiar problem in the past few months. Dumso.
The leaders need to be honest with us on this power issue. They can turn off the lights early in the morning and bring it back very late in the evening. Why are they not being forthcoming with us? If it's not Dumso, then what is it?
Chocho, one of the owners of the cold stores here, tells me on several occasions she has had to dispose of some products which went bad because of the unstable power supply.
The cost of the fish has also gone up. The ones we used to buy for 100 cedis now sells for between 400 to 600 cedis. The moment the fish becomes tender, no one wants to buy them. We are usually left with no option than to dispose of the cold foods that have gone bad. We are pleading with government to resolve the power crisis.
Another trader, Aja, says 3 weeks ago, when the Dumso became intense, tens of cartons of fish and meat products in his cold room went bad, running into loss of thousands of cedis.
The last time I...
What's the amount?
Amounts.
Yes.
Wow. You know, our chicken carton is 320. 20 cedis per one carton. The last time I threw about 10 boxes away. Yeah.
And the fishes?
The fish, the salmon to a cutting is 1,030 cities. We throw about 4 or 5 away because of all its melt and spoilt. Yeah.
Did you have to, after that, what happens? You have to bear the cost, you move on, you buy a new one, and then you start?
That one, the cost down. So far as that one is spoiled, we have to put different money into the business again. So we can't blame the government to come and give us any money now. So it's this thing.
Another cost the coastal managers bear is the purchase of spare parts to repair their gadget, which now breaks down consistently due to the flickering power.
And our machines also are used to say, the moment the light starts going off and on, it damages our machines. And these machines are expensive to repair. We are always incurring losses.
At this point, I grew interest in why Chocho and Aja are unable to provide alternative power to protect their investment.
Do you have generator you use for your...
I do not have a generator as a backup because I sell at the market. It is an open space. The noise from the generator will disturb traders and customers.
Not that we can't buy a generator, but where we are now, we don't have a space here to mount that generator at us now.
But in the middle of all this, Aja says officials of the ECG have visited their shops to already inform them about a possible bill increment.
How much approximately do you pay in a month?
This prepaid.
This prepaid?
Yeah, and so can you buy 1,000, 5,000, 2,000.
1,000, 5,000, 2,000 in a month?
Yeah.
For your prepaid?
Yeah.
We've seen some communications that the ECG is asking for more increment on the bill.
Yeah, it's true. They even came here.
They came here?
Yeah. Oh, okay. But our cold room, if they break, we off it. In the even the honest, yeah.
If they increase the bill, but there is no Dumso or light out, would you be willing to pay?
Oh yeah, yeah. If there's no Dumso or light out, the business is going on. We can pay whatever we get.
The two are united in the demand for a shadow to cut the loss.
Timunyo mampeni nenga zaze Dumso ni diye panicho. So Dumso obeya on now suni obia unse aye Dumso na aba esan say first mama mle suni enu say Dumso no wo ho wo hu na we de enye sa ukoka aye sin yesa ukochina ukwa aye sin yesa ubi so bi o say susude bia Dumso ne wo
Na nti mu kanche ni se se pa no cho so nu se dum so nu e wo ho a aya o maye nwa na o na nso na o man ni nyina nti ni ehu se dum so na e wo nti mu ma na so nti se se pa no
we are pleading with government to provide a dum so timetable as was done during John Mahama's regime. That's the least we can ask for.
They wo kakra na e beton ade a chi na kania ne be ban sa na e be kwa kofa na ya kofa enu be bo aye che ne se amu ye nu.
If there is a timetable about dum so, we all know that by this day, the lights will go off. You have to arrange yourself. You won't go and take plenty goods down before lights will go out. So you know what you take before the doomsday will come.
They hope stakeholders, including the ECG, GRIDCO, and government, gives a listening ear to them and find solutions to rescue their businesses. From Malata Market here in Accra, James Kwesi Aveji, on today's episode of Dumso Diaries for Joy News.
All right, so that is the piece my colleague James Aveji worked on, telling the impact of the on the everyday lives of Ghanaians. Well, joining us for this national dialogue, people who are well versed in this area, in studio I have Dr. Steve Manteau. He's chairman of the Coalition of Stakeholders on Electricity Contract and Arrangement. Doc, thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
Great. We also have another person who really you cannot talk about, energy issues without him. Mr. Kwame Janto Esquire. He is a very, very well-versed person in the energy issues in Ghana. Chief, good evening. Thanks for coming.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm good. Yes. Well, we also have another person that, well, when it comes to issues about generation, supply, when you're talking about it and then the workers need to speak, he comes into the picture here. Mr. Michael Nyantishi, he's chairman, Public Utilities Workers Union, Pool.
Thanks, sir. General Secretary.
He's General Secretary. Oh, thank you for coming, sir. And then, as someone who has taken time to really explain issues, when issues about the energy sector, be it fuel, be it power, comes up, he is a former Deputy Minister of Energy, an MP for Second D, lawyer Andrew Ejapa Mesa. Good evening, sir.
Evening.
We are on joy, else I would have asked you not to them.
Yeah. Of course. Not to them is a Ghanaian language.
Well,
very widely.
It's even better we speak in local language. For the ordinary man to understand.
I mean, I don't know.
That is right.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So we'll also be joined via Zoom by the ranking member on the Energy Committee, John Abdullahi Jinapo, as well as chairman of the committee, Honorable Samuel Atacha. He is joining us via Zoom as well. Again, we're expecting to be joined in the studio by Dr. Eric Blim Kwabla Akpetogbo. He is the chief executive for the Chamber of Independent Power Generators Ghana. He'll be joining us very, very shortly. But let me start with you, Dr. Steve Manteau. Where are we where we are?
Right. Thank you, Kojo. I presented a paper on the energy sector at the University of Cape Coast a while ago. And I find this paper relevant to our current situation. So with your permission, I'd like to read some excerpts from the paper. In 2013, a report authored by the World Bank noted, and the title of the report really is Energizing Economic Growth in Ghana, Making the Power and Petroleum Sectors Rise to the Challenge. And this is what the World Bank had to say. At a time when the Ghanaian economy is achieving sustained growth in excess of 6% annually, with ambitions to raise this further, there is a risk that misguided and inappropriate policies would lead to the power sector becoming a drag on the economy. And it wasn't too long when this prophecy was fulfilled, plunging Ghana into an unprecedented era of doomsday. Now, in its diagnosis of the problems confronting the energy sector, the World Bank was of the view that the energy sector faced two main challenges arising from forces external to the sector. And these were, one, lack of inadequate and secure quantities of reasonably priced fuel for power generation, and the lack of adequate public funds to finance the sector's investments requirements. So there are two angles to the problem. First is financial resources to be able to procure fuel. And then the second leg of it has to do with critical investments that needs to be made. And you are talking here about equipment renewal and installation of additional facilities to cope with growing population numbers and also rapid urbanization. And so these were the two major factors. And for me, this was in 2012.
Okay.
Today, 2024, we are here again. It's all like a deja vu, a very familiar place for all of us. And so I'm really happy that we are meeting today to have a discussion in terms of how we resolve these issues sustainably. Now, we have a national company that was not doing well. We handed it over to a private sector entity, operated the ECG using Ghanaian staff and engineers, and we saw some little improvements. So question is, why is it that when we put Ghanaians in place to manage state enterprises, they don't do so well? Is it their fault? Is it not their fault? I think these are issues we need to look into. I have a firm belief in the Ghanaian manager. Our Ghanaian managers are very competent when we give them the space to work. I recall at the time when we privatized the water company, Ghana Water, under a management contract arrangement, services by the company deteriorated, and those were the times we saw the Kufuor gallons all over the place. After 5 years of that experiment, we decided we're not getting our desired due from the arrangement, so we refused to renew the contract. Now, so we let go Aqua Vitense run and handed the management of the assets back to Ghana Water. And then services began to improve. And so the question is the Ghanaian manager very bad that he cannot manage a public asset? My response to this will be no. We need to deal with certain issues. And for me, the major issue we need to deal with is political interference and how we insulate these enterprises from the undue interferences from political authority. And here again, a lot of the times you see that our political authority blatantly break our laws. The proper way of filling vacancies in public sector institutions, including state-owned enterprises, is through the route of the Public Services Commission. So if a vacancy becomes available, it's supposed to be advertised. And then those who feel competent enough to do the job apply. And then they get the job. And when they are working, they don't need to look at the face of any politician. Today we have a situation where state-owned enterprise positions, sometimes even junior staff positions like communication or public relations officers, get appointed with a change of government.
But it's where we are as a result of, you know, human resource.
Human resource in the sense of what?
I mean, you're saying that politicians push people into positions even when they are not actually qualified for the job. And I'm asking, is our problems confronting the power sector as a result of that kind of development?
It's partly the reason, because we don't get the right people in the right place. Okay. So it's partly the reason. If we went through a competitive process and gave the needed space to these people to work, I'm pretty sure they would deliver.
Okay.
And so a lot of the times,
The reason, I believe strongly, the reason we are today not being told the truth, the entire truth about what has happened in the sector, is because of political considerations and the fear that we'll be handing over some advantage to the opposition party to campaign against the certain government.
All right, I'm grateful to you for that. Let me bring in the chairman of the public of the Mines and Energy Committee, because from all that you're saying, we need to find out whether or not they met the industry players some few days ago in Parliament to try to understand where we are. So let me bring him in and find out. Ms. Atacha, thanks for joining us here on the National Dialogue on Joy News.
Now, a pleasure as always.
I want to find out from you, were you told all the truth when you met the players in the sector?
Well, to a very reasonable extent, the issues were clear to us and the problems too were obvious. And I didn't see anybody trying to say that, oh, you are overruled in terms of what you are trying to assert as a problem that's confronting the issue. So it was a congregation of the key players in the supply chain. And that was a very comprehensive engagement, and it became clear to us. So we tabled about, let me count, we tabled about, I think, 8 observations and sent to the president, the stakeholders themselves, to the speaker, and then the majority leader and the minority leader, for them to understand what is going on. And then we expect that action will be taken on some of these matters to bring us to normalcy.
Okay.
Bear in mind, for good measure, close to over 7 years now, we have had power. So I have always asserted, why should we say that at the closing chapter of the president, I mean, we should come to this kind of situation.
Mm.
So he is acutely aware of some of the challenges that is affecting the sector now, and he owes it to his name to remedy it.
What were these 8 observations that you made?
Okay, if you permit me. We said that the president should secure the synergy among the critical players in the power value chain, especially the Minister for Finance, the Minister for Energy, the Mining Director of the Electricity Company of Ghana, the Chief Executive of the Volta River Authority, and the Chief Executive of Gridco were very, very much concerned about. One issue that cropped up was, as Riley said, fuel. You know, so we said the Minister for Finance used every financial community to make available to the generator, namely TAPCO, TICO, TT, TT1PP, TT2PP, Ameri, and the rest of them, same power and the rest of them. And if these are thermal setups, and critically, without the availability of fuel, they will not be able to generate what to expect. And it's a money issue, and it should be found, because the cost to the economy of having power outages sometimes is incalculable. So the money should be found to ensure that fuel is secure for these markets. And then we can be assured of a very consistent power generation. We're also concerned about the fuel efficiency, which is to say that if there's a plant that will receive fuel but will not generate adequate capacity as another plant, then we should look at the priority of generation in terms of the availability and do a selective way of giving fuel to them to secure optimum generation of the fuel. We're talking about the technical regulator was also asserting that even some maintenance issue are going to do with machine, and therefore data is a challenge. And we insisted that that should not be the case. We expect the Energy Commission to fix whatever technology it has to get along with the proper data, and then they will advise those who matter. Without the data, I don't think they'll be able to do what is right. One thing we said, without missing words, is what PRC is also asserting now, that it is imperative that the generality of Ghanaians should know in advance when they will be deprived of power, so that ECG's load shedding timetable should be clear. ECG was a bit worried about when RITCO gives professional and engineering, information before they can also plan along. We said that synergy should be so strong, and there shouldn't be a situation in which the people of Ghana going through such a challenge are also bereft of information regarding how they will plan their lives. I've heard about even mortuary issues, which I believe this might be desired. But what I will tell you up front, I keep saying it, I do not see any hospital facility where it is in anywhere in the world that will not have backup generation of power. Somebody will say that they don't even have money to power generators that they've hired. Look, it's imperative. You cannot come and tell somebody that I'm going to depend on erratic power supply. Somebody is operating theater, and because of that, there was no automatic connection between what ECG is bringing surgery room and what our system would tip it in immediately there's a power. It put life at risk. So fundamental to the run of a hospital is a backup generator, which is a must. And that is something that I have also said that we should look at it critically. I think we were very concerned about the cash waterfall mechanism, which is that, according to the players, the safest arrangement ECG should break in the money, and the money should be applied so that those who are generating the power will also have adequate money to continue, so that the circle of business will not be curtailed. We are 100% aware of some of the challenges that ECG is going through. But nevertheless, it is imperative that the cash waterfall mechanism should work. And if there are anything that the government should do so that ECG should stand on its feet about some of this, but we are also told that if and when they comply fully with it, and cash waterfall mechanism, they might suffer operational challenges. But the regulator is saying, well, that could not be something of concern to us. We should go by it. So let's look at what will make ECG comatose. Without probably they putting their hand in the cash waterfall mechanism. And let's see whether there will be a way to resolve this. We are also very much concerned that, ECG had a climb of revenue from about 69.7 million out, in 2021, and it went up to about 10 billion out in 2023, which is to say that they are determined to plug in the loopholes in terms of the generation returns. That if you have about 27% of what you generate being losses, I don't see how any serious undertaking can post profits if 27% of what is supposed to be your revenue goes down the drain. And if it means serious recapitalization of the nation's major electricity distributor, if you do so. So in short, these are some of the matters we pride into, and then we also profit the views of the committee. And then the president has it, the generators of power, everybody in the value chain is aware of what is tabulated. And we pray that very soon we shouldn't go through the crisis we find ourselves.
And that's some great work there that the committee did. Let me come in and let me come back to the studio and bring in Kwame Jonto here. You've listened to the chairman. Do these 8 points reflect what you think are the challenges confronting us? And what if solved, would bring us back to the adequate power supply that we're looking for?
Good morning to our viewers. Good evening to our viewers. Because you're always on the morning show, so see that as morning. Good evening to our viewers. Look, so far as I can see, I do not understand why companies that are in the same value chain, companies that are producing electricity in different forms, service to the public, are quarreling. Public. I've never understood it. I don't understand why PRC, ECG, GRIDCO, they are quarreling, seemingly in public. I think that should stop. It doesn't show confidence with the people, because the people are there to get confidence from those who are serving them. It doesn't show confidence. But the overarching challenge there is finance. And finance is in two sides. There's finance to run, and there's finance to earn. So I see the challenge. Finance is the top. You have debt. You have equipment inefficiencies. You have maintenance. You have cash waterfall. You have fuel purchases. You have personal interest. And you have politics.
Mm.
So when you look at debt, it's thrown through. And please, let me say, I don't want to situate these things only in this term. I'm situating it within this fourth republic. We have had a dumso because it keeps recurring all the time. It would be unfair to situate it in one term, because we have gone a full cycle and come back to the same thing. So it means the challenges that befell us then still befall us now. And we don't seem to have done anything about it. When you look at, maybe we've done something, but it hasn't been able to sort the problems. When you look at equipment efficiency, and you look at some of VIRA's plants, not all of them run efficiently. I understand that the single cycle plants are not that efficient. Should we not get efficient planning? How do we invest money in there to get that efficient planning? How about the cash waterfall mechanism? There's quite a lot of challenges there, quite a lot of questions to be answered there, quite a lot of things to be done to get it back in line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question of, one, leadership. It's a question of being able to follow what the cash waterfall was meant for. And when you look at the PwC report and you look at some of the recommendations they've made, really, you ask yourself, why couldn't we follow this from the word go? And please, as I say, we are looking at a period. We are not looking at a section here. Now, fuel purchases. We have combined cycles, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And we have some that take fuel. Which is most important? Should we use gas or should we use liquid for it? And this is where the personal interest clicks in.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are people who want to make money on these purchases. Where the personal interest is, you have personal interest to do with purchase of poles,
mm.
purchase of meters, purchase of fuel.
Mm.
And that stops those who are supposed to run because they have leaders they are working with. I do not think any of the heads of these departments
mm.
can come out and do anything they want to do if they are not directed to do it.
Okay.
There is a missing link somewhere that doesn't seem to fit. Because all of us sitting around the table and all the discussions that have gone on, we have complained about so many things, but we are not linking it to one arrow point.
There is
an arrow point. Leadership.
Mm.
Leadership. It's only today, unfortunately, that we've heard the president say, PURC, ECG, all you people, please, get together and do what you have to do. From the word go, that should have come out.
Oh, okay.
From so the leadership, word go, yeah,
you're looking at the president.
I'm looking at those who are supposed to make sure that these entities work. The CEOs of these institutions, the presidency, the ministries, even CSOs. But you see, the thing with CSOs, when CSOs come and tell you, look at this thing, ABCD is likely to happen, they are not listened to. Because there are elements within this scope who are interested in making sure that they too, they can get something out of it.
Mm.
So it's a challenge. It's a challenge where at this material moment, we have come to the last point. Please, as we go forward,
let's try our possible best to sit and iron out these things. I would have liked, but I don't think government would do it. I would have liked a situation where we are today with all the institutions, let's do an audit on all of them to see where everybody stands. Mm. This thing that they got PWE to do, let's do it with all of them if we want to move forward. Government might be doing a good thing, but it doesn't look so. It doesn't look so. If two institutions can bicker in public, it means there's no control somewhere. If the president really is now being briefed as if he doesn't know, then it becomes a challenge. Look, the question of Dumso, right now it has been confirmed, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And this was being said way back, that we have Dumso.
Yeah.
Did government want to hear? That's the politics that comes in there, because they have, unfortunately, excuse me for using the word, bastardized another government for going down the same line. So it looks as if we say it, we are also going down the same line. But Ghanaians know. Ghanaians know that that is what it is.
Okay.
So we've got to get to a stage. Mm. And for me, governance is the people who voted for you are part of governance. When they see and they feel it and they tell you, oh boy, Mr. Minister, please look at this, oh, please listen. And don't put a cloak over your head and say, we are in power. So that's it. Wouldn't it have been a great idea if where we are today, putting politics aside, the president now comes and says, look, I'm calling parliament, I'm calling opposition, I'm calling CSOs, I'm calling all the heads of all these institutions. Look, this Dumso thing that seems to plague us every government, let's sit and come to a good conclusion so that it doesn't happen here. Because you know why? Parties change.
Exactly.
Parties change all the time.
But the state is
exactly.
Is
so if we can sort it, and I'm sure if the president were to do that, and we could sort it and we see things happening in the right direction, who takes the, what do you call it?
All right. Let me bring in at this point, Lawyer Andre Japamesa here, because when this whole issue started, he was at the ministry. Lawyer, why did the ministry fail to show leadership when this whole issue started?
Let me say good evening to my co-panelists and, of course, to our cherished viewers and listeners. Because I understand that it is also on radio.
Joy FM, yes.
I'm not so sure whether the assertion that the ministry did not show leadership is fair. Okay, because there's been extensive engagements within the sector to try and resolve. Of course, I mean, this whole thing started sometime in January, if you like, where we had some issues with fuel. Okay, and of course, directives.
But issues with the cash water for mechanism preceded 2024.
Yeah, that's been there. Because we've been in government from 2017, right? It's not as if we haven't published Dumso timetable before. You recall the Dum CC that my minister announced. We published a timetable to deal with that situation because we're certain of the deficit that we had. In this case, the committee was told quite clearly. The PRC showed a graph that pointed to a difficulty in communicating outages. Because every day it swings depending on the fuel that was available. Hence, you hear the complaint of ECG that the time that they get a notification from
Gridco
is such that they cannot put that information out. So if you knew that you had a deficit of, say, 400 megawatts for 1 month, then you can publish a timetable for that month for people to then program themselves in a manner that then allows them to, as it were, have foreknowledge. But if you have 10 shortage today, tomorrow you have 40, the next day is 5, the following day is 20, the next day is 60, the next day is 20, then it poses a difficulty as to how you then put out the timetable for people to then know. Because assuming that you live in Ofanko, and ECG publishes a timetable for tomorrow, not knowing what really the deficit would be. And so because of that, you fail to attend work tomorrow in Kokomimili or some other place. And lights come on that day. And you would have been shortchanged, okay? And so the committee itself recommended that even if you cannot, the time space is such that you can't put out a timetable. Every day by close of day, at least indicate to on your website that there's going to be some outage so people can plan. The bickering issue that Mr. Jantua mentioned, it's unfortunate communication amongst agencies find itself in the public domain. Okay, I'm not sure that anybody has deliberately released a statement condemning one entity or the other. Of course, the regulator has issued sanctions at ECG, and it's within its power and mandate so to do. Okay, and when they issue those sanctions or they issue a regulatory directive, that ought to be made public. Mm. But the exchange between Gridco and ECG that found itself in the public domain wasn't intended, and that matter has been dealt with because the Honorable Minister has been on top of that on this matter. The presidency has been fully briefed. There's been several engagements trying to find a lasting solution to the issue. And truth be told, we've had some maintenance issues, some of which have been resolved. Some of it is ongoing. And we have some challenges with fuel, which on a daily basis, depending on what is available, then determines. But going forward, what have we done? And so, for example, this pipeline that has been built to Kumasi was all part of the long-term planning that we had initiated to ensure that the great studies that had been done in 2014, which had indicated the need for us to, for several reasons, including security and grid stability and transmission reliability, get a second or a third power enclave in the middle belt, right? Was then actualized through the moving of the plants that were sitting idle from 2021 when the BOT end date occurred because we had excess capacity within the system. And so the decision to move it, okay, knowing very well that that excess capacity was not going to be the case forever because your demand is growing on a year-by-year basis. So your excess would necessarily shrink. And so there will be a need for the plant someday.
Yeah.
So move it to Kumasi and, of course, help in building additional generation in that space. And so we signed the AXA agreement, which was condemned. Yet the tenant is Akufo-Addo hasn't done anything in the power space, which would come on in Kumasi in the 2027-2028 space. Mm. Okay. That allows us to move the gas up north, not reverse it through the WAPCO pipeline for a fee, because GMPC has reserved capacity on the Jansa pipeline. Of course, the discounted gas that was given to them, which was also condemned, facilitate that that investment. Okay, it was condemned roundly by all sectors or segments of people who really didn't take time to pay attention to the agreement itself. Because what they had done was that, look, Jansa was building its own pipeline, a 12-inch pipeline to service its own plants within the mining enclave. Government agency, Ghana Gas, requested it to increase the size to 20 because that enclave in itself was part of the right-of-way that they had intended long-term to build pipelines through. So why build two pipelines when you can have one? How do you pay Jansa? They say, give me a discount on the price of the gas that I'm buying from you, so that I can use that discount to defray the investment cost that I made. Of course, there was an option to purchase if Ghana Gas so had the resources to purchase the pipeline from Jansa. Roundly condemned, but it served a useful purpose because when GMPC also asked them after the institutional realignment that continue to Kumasi and we'll give you a discount on the additional pipeline that you are doing, which was also condemned, they reserved the capacity on it. Right? I believe 160 million scars per day or something like that, which then allows them to make a saving on the WAPCO reverse flow cost of about $7 million a month to now move gas to Kumasi on the reserve capacity to power plants within the enclave. They will sell that gas and they will make the requisite money to undo whatever discount that they had to give this Gensa to enable them build the pipeline to that space, right?
And would that be lesser than the $7 million WAPCO you pay?
Well, you may have to do the mathematics. I don't have the figures here, but I, as far as I'm concerned, it made a lot of sense. Okay, we can do the math and see. Question is, did you have the money to do the upfront investment? No. Somebody had the resources. And of course, it's not charity. And so you expect that they would also make a return on that investment. So we can do the analysis. But I'm saying that it was a good decision that was taken. And also now that you are taking away the reverse flow, if the decision is taken, allows you to then increase your flow from Nigeria. Because there's a capacity challenge in Tema, such that if you are flowing from west to east to power plants in Tema as we're doing now, there's a limitation on the gas that you can get from Nigeria to complement. And they are prepared to give us more gas because they have a lot of gas. But if you have a limitation there, then you are constrained. Now that limitation has been removed because of the Middle Belt enclave that we've created to allow us to get more gas to Nigeria. So my own expectation is that this thing will be short-lived, this fuel issue. Of course, there's also conversation about procuring additional. Indeed, when I was at the ministry, I don't know whether I've left.
You're hanging.
I chaired a committee that managed the maintenance schemes within all the gas to power value chain, okay, so that we can plan to procure liquid fuels if need be and all that. I don't know about personal interest. You know,
when they are contracted, of course, when they are contracting people in the sector have business.
I'm not so sure whether it's personal interest that drives it.
Really?
I'll explain. Because our primary fuel is gas. It's only about 10% of our generation that is dependent on liquid. And of course, gas is cheaper. And so at all times, we prefer to buy gas. It is only when you have a maintenance on the Atuabo gas pipeline or Jubilee upstream is doing some work that will impact gas flow. Or ENI is doing some work, because these are two domestic sources of gas. Mm-hmm. Then you program that within that period, you look for liquid fuel to power the plants. How that constitutes personal interest, I frankly do not know. But I like I said, it's not motivated by personal interest at all.
No, you know,
as we say in our local parlance, land.
Okay,
indeed, if it was a question of interest, I'm not sure we'll be pursuing vigorously gas from Nigeria, which has been the preference. There's been meetings, one of which I attended with my minister in Abuja, find ways to get Nigeria to support us, whilst we ourselves explore our upstream resources to derive more gas. And so, yes, there are issues. Of course, the politics will always be at play. But I believe that when the agencies met the committee, very frank with them, open, provided them with all the data and information. You could see the graph that PURC had generated from January, February, March, that showed the planned outages and the actual outages that were generated on a day-by-day basis from January through March. And coming in, I think I need to correct this issue about 44 outages per day. Maybe you are doing a simple extrapolation.
I mean, yeah, cumulatively, you between January and March, you recorded over 4,000.
Yeah, but you see, when you break two issues. Mm-hmm. Question of generation is one, or distribution challenges. That's what determines whether the power will go off in a community or not. And I'm saying that only 15% of that figure that you put out, 4,000, is attributable to generation, which is what GRIDCO manages. The 85 is ECG internal issues.
Okay.
So if the chief executive comes out to say that, look, the problems that we have in the
predominantly transformers. People say he's telling some falsehood, but there's some truth to it. Okay? Kumasi, it's a peculiar problem. The transmission line that connects power to the ECG transformer, it's 161 hour, I hear, but they have to move it to 330 kV or something like that. And so, no matter how much generation you have in the system, if that problem is not fixed, you have outages, incessant outages in Kumasi.
But you admit
that cannot
but,
be attributable.
But you admit that there's a shortfall in generation.
Oh no, I've said so. Not a problem at all. But I'm saying that it's only a matter that has been existing over the past few months.
Okay.
And the work that we are doing that will make this thing very short-lived. I don't want to sit here and give you a time frame, but very soon it will be done and over with.
How soon will that be? You see, you know the data, you see it. How soon will that be?
We have.
How soon will that be?
Oh, I'm not in a position to. I said to you that I don't know whether I'm still at the Ministry of Energy or I'm out.
All right.
Because remember, I've not been approved by Parliament.
We are still hanging.
So, yes, okay. I'm still hanging.
Now, I wanted to hear your point on the personal interest.
Exactly, because earlier, when a doc started from a research that was published some time ago, one of the issues was lack of reasonably priced fuel. So, if there are no personal interests,
so,
why would this be?
So two things, right? Like I said, our generation is predominantly gas powered. Only 10%. I think it's only the AXA plant. And when we don't have gas, of course, all of them, most plants use dual fuel. Okay. But the only one that depends solely on liquid fuel is the AXA plant, RFO. All the rest of them
the one you signed a deal with for Kumasi.
Well, there's one that is sitting in Tema.
Is the Kumasi one also single?
The Kumasi one hasn't come on stream. Okay. We haven't even started building.
All right, okay.
Okay. So predominantly we use gas to power our plants. It's only, like I said, it's only when we have maintenance issues in the value chain that we buy liquid fuel to power the other plants. Okay. But the gas itself. Sankofa gas, we all know it's very expensive.
Who negotiated it?
Well, you can answer that question. I know it wasn't the MPP administration. We all know. And so that puts the WACOG at a certain level. It's expensive. Of course, liquid fuel is dependent on the daily increases or reductions in the price of petroleum products.
Yes.
So if it rises, the price will go up. If it drops, right, consistent with the pricing window that NPA manages, it will come down. Okay, so yes, fuel is expensive. And that cannot be denied, whether it's gas or liquid. But predominantly because we use more gas as opposed to liquid fuel. Okay, so for example, last year, if my recollection is anything to go by, we had two maintenance outages for the year. There was an April 1 Ghana Gas, and there was a September ENI, altogether about 36 days or so. It cost us almost $450 million to buy liquid fuel to power the plants for that period. Gas won't cost you anywhere close to that, right? So at all times, our preference is gas. Sankofa will pay some $49, $50 million per month. That Ministry of Finance pays outside the cash waterfall mechanism. There's a post-foundation jubilee volumes that we are getting in the region of about $10 million per month. That Ministry of Finance is picking the tab outside the cash waterfall. Because if you put all of that in the cash waterfall mechanism, after paying the IPPs, some 43 or so million, now it's gone up to, I believe, 61 or 62 million. There's nothing to go around for the other players in the value chain. Okay, so the fuel being expensive is true. But I don't see, still don't see where that personal interest arises. It's only when we don't have gas that we of necessity. And presently, if we have issues with that, there's a maintenance outage that is coming on, I believe, in May, and then also in September, we necessarily have to buy liquid to complement the available gas that will be there.
When you were talking, I mean, Mr. Janto mentioned about Sankofa, you said that, well, you can know where it's coming from. Now, from that analysis, isn't your negotiations and the negotiations that you leaders engage in influenced in any way by personal interest?
I don't know.
He won't say it.
No.
You can't say it.
Kwame, it's not a question of I can't say it to you. I frankly don't know. Because there's an investment component that will determine whatever price point, negotiated price point that you reach. But it still doesn't take away the fact that you can make a conclusion whether the price is expensive or not. Your option really is to decide whether you want the investment or not. Okay, but Sankofa is extremely expensive. It's a matter of fact.
The negotiation of the Sankofa gas was led not by technocrats, but by politicians.
Okay.
And in the contract, we put in a clause that says, even if cheaper gas becomes available, we bind ourselves to take the expensive gas.
Oh.
But it was a take or pay.
And after that contract. After that contract, the Italian Prime Minister, for the first time in the history of this country's relationship with Italy, flew to Ghana as if to say thank you. I served on the World Bank Extractive Industries Advisory Board at the time. In one of our meetings, a remark was made that Italy, that's Eni, couldn't have gotten this juicy deal anywhere in the world. This is what we did to ourselves. So you're right, it's expensive, but we inflicted it on ourselves.
Did we not once upon a time have political meters? Was that not personal interest?
The shirt meters around the
exactly. So what are we talking about?
Who installed
them? Nobody can tell me that there is no personal interest in here.
Okay.
What we need to do is to be able to cure it.
Okay.
That's the most important thing.
Interesting. But Ms. Mesa, when you were speaking about fuel, gas, you know, GRIDCO asked government to increase gas supply from Nigeria. Have we had any agreement with the NGAS, and how much are we looking at?
Well, VRA is leading that discussion with NGAS. Of course, with support from the ministry. Like I said, I've been in meetings with my minister in Abuja, speaking to the gas minister in Nigeria to see how they can support us. And I'm not in the position to confirm at this point whether they've reached definitive agreements. But like I said, there were bottlenecks in Tema. Okay. And so with the pipeline going to Kumasi now, that bottleneck is going to be taken away for us to receive more volumes from Nigeria. And I'm sure that in a matter of days, that if it hasn't already been concluded, it would be done.
Okay.
Once the minister is here, let me ask a question.
Okay.
There are associated and non-associated fields. And probably because of this whole thing about renewables, associated fields might be difficult to drill. Between the time of this government being in place, not one exploration have we done. Why don't we go in there and let's find non-associated fields and start drilling our sources so that we get our own gas. All this gas that we are buying, it is money we don't have. Because when you look at all that we are discussing, where's the end point? Finance.
Yes.
That's where the end point is. So even if you're going to look at this thing, we can break it down. Where is the finance going to come from? That's the issue that we should try and answer.
All right, interesting.
Wait, you better more than I know where the finance in upstream exploration comes from. You.
But gas is a transition fuel.
Of course.
That's why I situated non-associated fields.
I don't have a problem. But you still have to do exploration. You still have to invest in drilling to bring out the gas.
Yes. Yes,
and
it's a transition fuel, right?
It's a question of transition fuel. For me, it doesn't play in this.
But it's not something
we need the gas. But you need the gas.
The same process you go through.
Through to explore oil. Same.
And the same for oil.
Okay.
For me, the worry is that our fields, the three fields, seems to be plateauing.
Okay. If you look at the data for the last 3 years,
that's the point I'm making.
It's been declining.
So we need to
explore.
If we don't add to the reserve, then we have a problem.
Okay. Yeah, but I agree with you. But of course, when we came, we've added to the reserve. You say it's not a new field, but Jubilee Southeast was a new development that has added 30,000 barrels to our reserves. Of course, Pecan, we all expect it to come on stream very, very soon.
Ultra deep.
We've given approvals for ENI to explore Akoma and what you call it, Eban. Okay? We are having discussions with Jubilee partners on infrastructure-led exploration within the neighboring fields. And all these things are happening.
Okay.
So it cannot be the case that we haven't done anything in the past period.
We've gotten ENI to prioritize investments in Cote d'Ivoire over Ghana. And that chief executive of ENI has relocated from the country.
Yeah.
Because he's been sought after for
of course,
allegedly well, contempt of court and all that.
Yeah.
So they are channeling most of their investments into the Cote d'Ivoire.
Yeah.
Why don't you give attention and resolve this matter with ENI once and for all?
Where are we on that case?
We're expecting the outcome of the arbitration sometime in July. You see, I agree. And over the period that I've been at the Ministry of Energy, I've had extensive engagements, or I've been involved in conversations with ENI to try and settle the issue between themselves and Springfield.
Okay.
That's another one.
This issue will not be short-lived if we don't resolve the full dimension of it sustainably.
I agree. But the point is this. The point is this. These are two private right owners. Two private. ENI and Springfield. There's a limit to what you are the resource owner, can do. It's a question of law. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that every time that I hear the talk about ENI Springfield, the sense I get is, but why don't you allow ENI to have its way? Because that's exactly what they want. Please,
no,
with respect.
No, I'm agreeing with you. It shouldn't be.
Precisely.
It shouldn't be.
So.